This is Continental Media 0509. Glenn Hauser here with my more or less monthly supplement to the weekly World of Radio. Continental Media is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave. Made possible by Universal Radio for quality amateur and shortwave equipment. Ask for their catalog at 1-800-431-3939 or visit their website www.universal-radio.com. Another of their websites is www.dxing.com, where you'll find audio of this program and lots more useful info, including an archive of DX listening digests. Mapping the Venezuelan Media Revolution is the text of an editorial analysis by Charlotte Eimer of BBC Monitoring, published September 2nd, from which I will excerpt. The media image of Venezuela before Hugo Chavez became president in 1998 was empty, according to Blanca Eichhout, that's E-E-K-H-O-U-T, head of state-run TV station Channel 8, VTV. It was portrayed as a rich country, an oil country, a country of beauty queens, not a country of people waking up at 4 a.m. so they could be exploited at work for a pittance to try to keep their families alive, she told ZNet in September 2004. The Venezuelan media is dominated by independent TV channels with a political agenda set by their powerful owners. RCTV and Venevisión together claim 80% of the audience share. But by 2002, violent attacks against both the private and state-owned media were becoming a regular occurrence. International watchdogs began to monitor the situation, criticizing the behavior of the commercial media and President Chavez's attitude towards it. Government supporters believe the short-lived April 2002 coup would not have happened without the backing of a group of media moguls, dubbed the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse by Chavez. The major channels were criticized for their failure to cover scenes of looting in Caracas during the coup attempt. At the time, they said security concerns for reporters prompted the decision, but viewers were told the capital was calm. The channels then broadcast cartoons and movies, rather than covering Chavez's historic return to Miraflores presidential palace. Journalist Andres Izarra, who had worked for CNN and NBC in the U.S. before returning to Venezuela, as production manager for the Radio Caracas TV newscast, he resigned in protest. Izarra cited RCTV head Marcel Granier's order of zero Chavism on the screen. Caracas Daily Tal Cual recalled in August 2004 as evidence of the news blackout. Attacks against the media escalated, leading the Inter-American Court of Human Rights to ask the government to adopt precautionary measures designed to protect the lives and freedom of expression of media workers who had been attacked. They were never adopted. In December 2002, the press again became the target of Chavez's wrath, this time for its role in an 8-week strike that sought to cripple the country's oil industry. According to government estimates, some 700 pro-strike ads were aired every day on commercial networks. When the strike ended early in 2003, politicians began to debate new broadcasting regulations, designed, the government said, to control propaganda without violating freedom of expression. But international NGOs took a different view of the law of social responsibility in radio and television, acronymized RESORTE, which allows the government to suspend stations that promote, defend, or incite breaches of public order or that are contrary to the security of the nation. When the legislation was passed in November 2004, Human Rights Watch America's director José Miguel Vivanco warned that it severely threatens press freedom in Venezuela. HRW was not alone in viewing the vaguely worded restrictions and heavy penalties established in the Resorte law as a recipe for self-censorship by the press and arbitrariness by government authorities. Some analysts believe the airtime the commercial media now gives to officials and the perceived toning down of anti-Chavez rhetoric is a direct result of the new law, which increased penalties for anyone who may seriously offend the president or defame officials. They claim the legislation seeks to criminalize political dissent. But others say the change in tone is merely a reflection of the opposition's realization that they can no longer afford to ignore Chavez's popular appeal. Since the law came into force, a group of high-profile journalists have appeared in court to answer charges relating to reports that portrayed a negative image of the government. Some have also been found guilty of defaming government officials. Meanwhile, the resignation of Andres Izarra from RCTV had proved to be a smart career move. After a short spell at the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, he returned to run the Maysanta Command's successful presidential recall referendum campaign and play a key role in reshaping the government's media and communication strategy as the head of the Information and Communications Ministry. Initially, Izarra's role was to strengthen the state-owned media and lower the levels of aggression among some private media. But by late 2004, he was working on a strategy to democratize the airwaves, supporting Latin American integration through communications, and promoting the image of the revolutionary process at home and abroad, as explained by the publication Tal Cual. However, a meeting of the Inter-American Radio Broadcasting Association, AIR, in May 2005 concluded that far from encouraging freedom of expression, Venezuela had become the country with the greatest restrictions on journalism in the Americas, a situation exacerbated by government pressure on commercial outlets. Later that month, the government rejected a recommendation by HRW that the Organization of American States, Rapporteur on Press Freedom, visit the country, claiming, the Caracas Daily El Nacional reported, that the NGO's proposal was dictated by extremist opinions from within the United States. In July 2005, the Supreme Court ruled against the owners and managers of 24-hour satellite news channel Globovisión TV in a case brought by members of four civic associations. Globovisión was found guilty, Venezuelan National Radio reported on 19 July, of continually broadcasting messages aimed at the sudden and unconstitutional removal of the president from power and at generating opinion patterns that foment political instability and drive the population towards collective hysteria and psychotic dissociation. Before the legislation came into force, the government busied itself pumping money into community TV and radio, believing its grassroots focus would counter the influence of the commercial media. A 5 gigabolivar fund, that's approximately $2.3 megadollars, was set up to finance the startup costs of 30 new community media outlets throughout the country, El Nacional confirmed in September 2004. By the end of the year, 153 community radio and TV stations had registered with the National Telecommunications Commission, CONATEL, and were up and running. Of these, just 10 were based in the capital. The best-known of the community outlets, Katia TV, would become a model for Telesur, the new pan-Latin American TV channel, regarded by Washington as a mouthpiece for anti-U.S. propaganda. In July 2005, Andres Izarra resigned as communications minister to take control of Telesur, created to end what Chavez has called CNN's media dominance in the Americas. "We must break up that media dictatorship. We have a media source that is at the people's service. We must make people fall in love with the idea of integration," Chavez said on a visit to Uruguay. Some media analysts in the USA have already labeled the fledgling channel a Latin Al Jazeera, run by radical leftists trying to impose their own media monopoly in the region. But Izarra told Caracas Daily El Universal his resignation would lend impartiality to Telesur, ensuring that the Chavez administration does not maintain a direct influence over the channel and we can guarantee a certain degree of independence. The channel, which began broadcasting on 24 July, Libertador Simón Bolívar's birthday, is a joint venture by Venezuela, Cuba, Argentina, and Uruguay, based at the VTV offices in Caracas. Next on the agenda is Radio Sur, a network of radio stations throughout the continent that will complement Telesur, reaching remote areas where there is no TV coverage. That analysis by Charlotte Eimer of BBC Monitoring. Here's some partially Canadian media history, started by Charles Gauthier in Quebec on the WTFDA list. Videotron is one of the oldest and largest cable companies in North America and is part of the Quebecor media empire. They own newspapers, magazines, TV stations, and offer cable and internet access to more than 3 mega-Quebecers. One of the most famous accomplishments is to have brought cable to London, England households in the late 80s. Bob Cooper in New Zealand replies, "Actually, their parent is Rediffusion, which launched in 1932, radio via wire. For a raft of reasons, no electricity in flats, uniqueness of English living and housing styles pre-World War II. Normal AM radio reception in many congested regions of the UK was very poor or non-existent. Rediffusion created a wired system, directly akin to modern cable TV, where a quiet location and multiple radio receivers distributed at audio frequencies 1 to 5 different radio services to homes. In homes, individual speaker, radio channel selector switches, all for a few pence per month. In 1949, Rediffusion began a similar service with TV, BBC One being the only channel at the time, and created TV sets without tuners or IF amplifiers because the video and audio were distributed first through twisted pair along with radio and later in slightly better wire at video frequencies. In 1952, they sent a team of folks to Montreal to create a similar TV service for that city, which preceded any local TV service, so they ran films, did live studio stuff. When CBMT, as Canada's first TV station, signed on the air in September 53, there were 80,000 waiting and connected TV sets on Videotron Rediffusion. They also tried to do the same thing in Barbados and one or two other British spots, Hong Kong. Eventually, Montreal's system grew out of baseband, audio and video distribution networking, to regular RF coaxial cable networking. They have a long, proud history. Somebody should research and write a book about their first-time accomplishments. Now to the present and the future. Another editorial analysis published by BBC Monitoring, this one by Stephen Howey, on 25 July. U.S. broadcasters and authorities agree on analog TV switch-off date. It appears to have been decided, according to Broadcast Engineering, on 21 July, during testimony at a Senate Commerce Committee hearing. The National Association of Broadcasters dropped its opposition to a fixed date for the switch-off, accepting that analog broadcasts will end by 1 January 2009. Broadcasters in the U.S. have been reluctant to agree to a fixed date for the switch-off, citing little public interest and the slow take-up of digital TV receivers as reasons not to commit to a fixed date so soon. They argued that the broadcasters would lose viewers and money from the switchover to digital broadcasting. This reluctance displayed by the broadcasters has delayed progress of the rollout of digital TV across the USA and has pushed back the FCC's previously favored switch-off dates. Until recently, 2006 was the favored date for the switch-off to have taken place. The 1996 Telecom Act says broadcasters have to return their analog broadcasting licenses to the government by 31 December 06. However, an admission on the official FCC-run digital TV website, dtv.gov, says the date may be extended until most homes, that is 85% in an area, are able to watch the DTV programming. There is still skepticism that the 2009 date is achievable, according to media analysts. The biggest outstanding issue is exactly how the switchover will be achieved. With many millions of TV sets, and in many cases multiple sets in each household, requiring conversion in just over 3 years, there are concerns regarding the cost of the analog switch-off to the consumer. Some believe the government should subsidize the cost of integrated digital TVs and converter boxes, the latter of which are eventually expected to cost between $50 and $100, said Broadcast Engineering. At the hearing, Gene Kimmelman, director of the Consumers Union, said he believes the government should subsidize all required hardware for digital TV, even for the affluent. Others argue that the government should only help poorer households with the digital switchover. Much is now being done to ensure that the 2009 switch-off date can be adhered to. FCC has ruled that all large TV sets and 50% of mid-sized sets, that is 25 to 36 inches, sold now, must have built-in DTV tuners. All mid-sized sets must have the tuners by 1 March 06. That was originally 1 July 06. And all TVs with a screen size of 13 inches or more must have a DTV tuner by 1 July 07, along with all other devices which can receive TV signals, including video and DVD recorders. There is no rule yet set for smaller televisions. Senator Ted Stevens, chairman of the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, suggested that another fixed date should be set, after which it would be illegal to sell a TV without a DTV decoder. There's also great debate about the carriage of digital TV stations on cable networks. According to a paper by the NAB in September 2004, a proposal from the FCC Media Bureau plan had said that broadcasters should be able to choose whether their services will be available by cable in digital form only, or if they can be downgraded to an analog signal, which would remain after the switch-off date. Viewers of this analog cable service would count towards the 85% threshold required to enact the analog terrestrial switch-off. However, the NAB said that proposal would leave these broadcasters permanently condemned to analog, putting to waste some of the millions of dollars spent in digital technology and offering no advantages to the viewer. Alternately, the digital-only option would leave many viewers without, for instance, their local television station. A 2009 switch-off date, if successfully implemented, could make the U.S. one of the first countries in the world to completely close down its network of analog terrestrial transmitters in favor of digital terrestrial broadcasting. In the U.K., analog services are due to be switched off region by region between 2008 and 12. However, the Edinburgh-based Scotsman newspaper reported 24 July that this may now be delayed further owing to London's successful Olympic bid and the wish to ensure that as many people as possible can watch the events. In Australia, the government is under pressure to delay the current expected switch-off date of 2008, with broadcasters blaming apprehensive consumers and government restrictions on free-to-air broadcasting, so reported the Melbourne newspaper The Sunday Age on 24 July. In Germany, large regions are already broadcasting only digital terrestrial TV. Their switchover model is one of the most successful and is based on an analog-digital simulcast period of only a few months. The German government do not appear to have committed themselves to a final overall date for 100% switchover. That analysis by Stephen Howey of BBC Monitoring. Here's a rejoinder by Harry Helms on the ABDX list, who also runs the futureofradio.typepad.com blog, to the discussion about the analog TV switch-off. Anybody want to make a bet that January 1st, 2009 deadline is going to be extended? There's no way analog TV channels go dark by that date unless Congress buys converter and adapter boxes for everyone in the country. I can't believe any congressional representative or senator who wants to run for re-election, while explaining why he or she voted to make most of the TV sets in their district or state useless. You can take away people's incomes through taxes or civil liberties through the Patriot Act, but when you take away their Oprah or NFL football, there'll be hell to pay. If Congress is serious about reclaiming analog TV channels for other uses, they need to stop hectoring broadcasters and instead start funding the costs consumers, also known as voters, will incur in making the transition to digital TV. More on the legislative front. This article, I must point out, was published August 8th in the St. Petersburg Times. Things may have changed since then. Let us hope the proposed bill has died. Critics say a bill would force a government agency to disseminate much of its data only to private companies, by Tom Zucco. Yes, we're talking about weather data. Senator Rick Santorum, Republican of Pennsylvania, the third-ranking Republican in the Senate, introduced a bill in April titled the National Weather Service's Duties Act of 2005. It would clarify the duties and responsibilities of NOAA and the NWS and, quote, protect life and property. Santorum said the bill's intention is to keep NOAA from competing with private companies. The main task of the Weather Service, he said, is to provide public alerts for emergency conditions, such as tornadoes and severe weather, which the bill would require the agency to continue. But critics say the bill would force NOAA to disseminate much of its data, collected at taxpayer expense, only to private companies. The result would be that the government's ad-free websites would go dark. They point to a key sentence in the bill involving the cabinet post that oversees NOAA as proof. The Secretary of Commerce shall not provide or assist other entities in providing a product or service that is or could be provided by the private sector. That, say opponents of the bill, is akin to telling the U.S. Postal Service that FedEx and UPS would have exclusive use of all the government's package delivery equipment, and that the post office could only deliver packages if it didn't interfere with private companies. Opponents of the bill are also quick to point out that 14 private weather forecasting companies, including AccuWeather, one of the biggest players in the field, have their headquarters in Santorum's home state, Pennsylvania. Well, the article continues for some time, but you get the gist. We'll include a link in the summary. Thanks to Terry Kruger for sending it to us. And one more legislative item. This one apparently, unfortunately, a done deal. This is an editorial in the New York Times by Michael Downing, or maybe it's op-ed, titled Endless Summer. Congress has an amazing new scheme to cut crime, automobile fatalities, and energy consumption. There is one hitch. We have to stay in bed until sunrise during the first week of November. Lights out, TVs and radios off, and please stay away from that coffee maker. Doing so might interfere with breakfast, school attendance, morning workouts, and jobs. That's because during the week, the sun won't rise until 7:30 a.m. at the earliest. If you live in the western edge of your time zone, expect darkness until 8:30 a.m. Sorry, Boise. Good night, Grand Rapids. Congress has extended daylight saving time, hereafter IGH insist on calling it shifting time, by 4 weeks. In 2007, our clocks will spring forward on the second Sunday of March and fall back on the first Sunday of November. And frankly, there may be another hitch or two in the plan. First, the trick of shifting unused morning light to evening was intended to exploit long summer days, when sunrise occurs between 4 and 5 a.m. standard time, hours of daylight that do not exist during the short days of March and November. Second, after nearly 100 years, daylight shifting has yet to save us anything. The idea of falsifying clocks was proposed by the British architect William Willett in 1907, but the Germans were the first to try it in 16, hoping it would help them conserve fuel during the First World War. Then Britain and America gave their clocks a whirl. The fuel savings never materialized, and daylight saving was so unpopular here that Congress repealed it before officially declaring an end to the war. That most Americans still believe we save daylight to help farmers tells you something about the quality of debate on this perennial controversy. In fact, farmers hated daylight saving. They needed morning light to get their dairy and crops to markets, and they were powerful enough to rally popular opinion against the law. For that reason, except during World War II, Congress did not dare to pass a national daylight saving policy for almost 50 years. It was New York City that kept the practice alive, and it did so by passing a local daylight ordinance in 1919. This served the powerful department stores, which wanted evening light to tempt working people to shop on their way home. Wall Street profited too. Fast time preserved 1 hour of overlap with London traders, whose clocks sprung forward every year. By 1965, 71 of the largest American cities practiced DST, and 59 did not. One airline reported 4,000 calls a day from customers asking what time it would be in their destination cities. The U.S. Naval Observatory dubbed the nation the world's worst timekeeper. And so in 1966, Congress passed the Uniform Time Act, which gave us 6 months of standard time and 6 months of daylight shifting. This wise compromise has since been compromised out of existence. We now face 8 months of DST. Before we bargain our way into a permanent year-round policy, we should know whom we have to thank for saving us nothing. Richard Nixon infamously mandated year-round daylight saving in 1974 and 5. This did not soften the blow of the OPEC oil embargo, but it did put school children on pitch-black streets every morning until the plan was scaled back. A Department of Transportation study concluded that Nixon's experiment yielded no definitive fuel saving. It optimistically speculated, however, that DST might one day help us conserve as many as 100,000 barrels of oil a day. Based on that projection and the hope of reduced street crime, in 1986 and again this year, Congress extended DS by a month. But there's been no corresponding reduction in oil consumption or crime. The new 4-week daylight saving extension won't save fuel or lives, but it will put our clocks seriously out of sync with Europe's, costing airlines $150 million a year. It'll foul up clocks and computers, confuse trade with our continental neighbors, and make it impossible for many Jews to recite sunrise prayers at home. Sure, later sunsets will encourage Americans to go outside, to the mall or the ballpark, but this will only put more cars on the road for more hours of the day. The petroleum industry recognized daylight savings potential to increase gasoline consumption as early as 1920. And it is a sweet deal for retailers. Candy makers have long lobbied to extend daylight saving past Halloween. In 1986, the golf industry told Congress the extension would boost fees and retail sales by as much as $400 mega annually. The barbecue industry saw a $150 mega bonanza. And 7-Eleven convenience stores stocked up for a $50 mega rise in sales. Michael Downing, author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time, concludes, I am a fan of long summer evenings and of social policy that promotes conservation. But I can't promise I won't turn on a light until 8:30 in the morning. Come November, wouldn't it make more sense for Congress to leave the clocks alone, ask us to turn down our thermostats at night, and maybe spring for a pair of flannel pajamas? Speaking of boondoggles, how about this? From theinquirer.net via the CGC communicator, via Kevin Redding, ABDX. About that 3% telephone tax and the war with Spain. In 1889, the war with Spain prompted the imposition of a 3% tax on all telephones, which at the time was an emerging technology with very few users. Now more than a century later, the tax continues to defy repeal. But one California congressman has introduced legislation aimed at putting an end to the $6 giga annual levy that was originally supposed to expire after 1 year. The propagation outlook from Greg Hardison, broadcast band update. Receiving an extended lease on life is WA2XMN, the commemorative experimental outlet from the old Armstrong FM tower in Alpine, New Jersey, on an old-time low-band FM frequency, 42.8 megahertz. Initially planning to operate only for 2 days in June, XMN is now authorized to continue its specialty casts until sometime in 2010. Making the Xers salivate is the realization that the station is now authorized to operate into the next sunspot maximum on its 11-year cycle. It's likely the 250-watt station will be heard into skip areas in the Midwest and beyond toward the end of its lifespan, thanks to those solar influences. More about it from Al Clace, in charge of the station, via Ken Kopp. WA2XMN has been granted a full 5-year experimental license. Intentions stated in the application include recreating Armstrong's original Yankee Network relay system. Goal of a test in August was to evaluate the path between Alpine and the Paxton, Massachusetts tower site on Assiniboinskit Hill. The original network had an intervening relay at Meriden, Connecticut. All the details at www.wa2xmn.ar88.net. Glenn Hauser here, concluding Continental Media 0509, also known as World of Radio Extra 63.